You're listening to Leaders in Payments and Fintech, a podcast brought to you by Edgar Dunn & Company, the global payments and fintech consulting firm. Coming to you from the City of London, I'm your host, Martin Kodrish. And in this series, I'm meeting with leaders and practitioners across the industry to find out what it takes to bridge the gap between strategy and execution. My central question is, how can we commercialize and bring the benefits of ever deeper new technology to market in what continues to be a highly regulated industry? If you enjoy these interviews, please do subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or your podcast platform of choice. So enough of the intro, let's get straight into today's episode. This week, we meet Shiraz Ritwik, Head of Banking, Payments, and Insurance Sectors at Latent View Analytics. Latent View Analytics is a fast-growing digital analytics firm that helps companies combine digital and traditional data to drive digital transformation and gain a competitive advantage. Ritwik shares some insightful case studies on how advanced analytics and AI can be used to streamline financial processes, prevent fraudulent transactions, and gain a connected view of data from marketing campaigns. Some great tips and insights, so I do hope you enjoy this conversation with Shiraz Ritwik from Latent View Analytics. So Shiraz, welcome to the Edgar Dunn podcast. It's great to have you with us today. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, thank you. I'm just back from some extensive travel up and down the East Coast, but glad to be back and settled in.
And so you're calling in from Rhode Island?
That's right. We're nestled somewhere in between Boston and New York. And most people do believe that Rhode Island is like Long Island. And then we have to just recalibrate the latitude and longitude a little bit, and we're back in the right place.
Perfect. Yeah, it's a nice area of the US. I haven't been for a while myself, but I have driven down from Boston to New York. So that's quite a nice drive if you remember, Riley. It's quite a scenic route. So anyway, so you're head of banking, financial services, consumer and hospitality growth at Latent View Analytics, right? So looking forward to diving into our topic today around data and data analytics. We've got a bunch of questions that we can go through, but maybe we can kick off with just a personal introduction from yourself.
Certainly. And thanks for the opportunity, Martin. I'm glad to be on the Edgar Dunn podcast. A lot of the work we're doing with fintech and financial services centers around data, and I'd love to talk about that and how we enable some of the largest payments networks, processors, and marketplaces to drive impact for them. But for myself, I'm an analytics professional with about, I believe at this point, about 20 years of experience. Started out life of all things as an IT outsourcing researcher and analyst. Spent a lot of time with the CXO level right at the beginning of my career. That was quite a privilege, understanding how the space works. But then I quickly moved into sourcing strategy, and from there into spend analytics, and finally into customer analytics, which is where it was a huge unlock to be able to grapple with customers at a scale of millions of customers, whether it was loyalty programs for retailers or whether it was the customer base for wireless network providers or cable providers. The ability to be able to look at customers at scale and yet personalize at a one-on-one level is something that I've been fortunate to grapple with in my journey. So today, as I enter my third year with Latent View, I'm actually fortunate to be enabling a lot of the change that we're driving across the payments area, but more broadly across banking, financial services, and insurance, and the intersections into consumer businesses like CPG, as well as hospitality. So that's kind of my background. Great to be here.
Okay, great. So, I mean, obviously data is a hugely important topic, and it's been an important topic for as long as I remember, quite honestly. What is your current view on the state of data within the, let's say, payments and fintech industry relative to other industries that you cover, right? You've mentioned consumer and hospitality. Obviously, financial services is one of the most data intensive industries. But what is the current state of using that data in our industry, would you say?
Well, let me actually start off with an example that kind of illustrates this. So when we stepped into one of the large payment processors about a year ago, we looked at their environment and we realized that there was a huge disparity of data sources, and those data sources were not talking to each other. So you had instances of Netezza, SQL Server, and then talk about Snowflake and talk about unifying all this into a single data lake. But even at something as mature as a payment processor that serves millions of merchants, we found that there wasn't a very good way to make all of this data talk to each other and be able to derive insights out of that so as to drive decisions. And I think that is emblematic of the condition of data, the state of data in fintech and payments today. If we can solve those 101 problems for a lot of fintech today, I think it enables some really innovative use cases around the usage of that data to be able to get customers more value and to be able to drive more impactful business for our clients as well. Now, if I make this comparison with, let's say, the state of data in CPG or in other industries, like tech, for instance, tech is obviously way ahead in terms of data building, data organization and adoption. At the same time, the velocity of data is similar in tech as well. So if I compare something like an OTT platform where every second you're generating viewership data for customers and digital journeys for customers, and then you have millions of those customers across several countries, you're actually looking at data at a scale where everything that you want to do becomes a really, really complex problem. So let's take a problem like identity resolution, for instance. Resolving whether a mobile phone ping and, let's say, a TV audience belongs to the same household is a very interesting identity resolution problem, which is best solved by graph networks. When you're looking at about 40 to 50 billion rows of data overall, how do you construct those networks to be able to identify that here is a household and this mobile phone, this viewership device, and this tablet are all linked to the same household? Even graph solutions of today start breaking down when you start to try and solve identity resolution with that kind of approach. So there is definitely, so the state of data in tech, coming back to the topic, is kind of imposing challenges on the solutions that are available today. And I'm sure that there's going to be a lot of innovation to solve some of this.
Okay. Just for the sake of my audience, can you just define what graph network is, just to elaborate on that point?
Certainly. So in the recent years, there's been a new approach in terms of organizing databases, more in terms of the interlinkages and the interconnects that different pieces of information have. And graph networks are different from your traditional ways of organizing databases into either relational databases or even big data databases, where these inherent connections are easier to discover. And there are providers like, let's say, a Neo4j or others who can help organize and capture your data in the form of graph.
Perfect. So I'm sure, you know, within the BFSI industry vertical, there are pockets of players who are using data in a smart way, in an equivalent way to other industries like tech that you've mentioned. I mean, you know, typically we think that incumbent banks tend to be laggards, right? And perhaps digitally native fintechs perhaps have got, you know, their data structure, their data strategy more designed, built into the original, to the technology design. Would you agree with that?
I think that's a great reference frame to have, because if I think about acquisition of customers, for instance, it's definitely an area that makes this comparison much more stark. So we can see that networks, for instance, which are essentially fintechs, if you compare those with, let's say, the personal banking side of many banks, large banks, the focus is on essentially the same customer. That person who's going to get a new credit card. In the bank, it is much more challenging for folks to kind of stitch together a view of that customer and the headroom that is available in terms of, you know, their spend with other banks and then target them effectively. Whereas if I compare that with a fintech, the view is somewhat different. There is a lot of transactional data available. There isn't as much information around, let's say, the kinds of categories of spend that a consumer might have. It is there depending on the offers that are consumed by that customer and provided by the network, but not such fine-grained visibility into, let's say, the basket. So if I go to a CVS and I make 5 purchases, 5 items will show up on the bill, but not necessarily the exact SKUs. And so the payment provider will have visibility into the overall spend and maybe the individual line item spend, but not necessarily the individual categories within that spend. Whereas a retailer or a bank issuer might know that, you know, a certain offer was applied on that spend, and therefore a certain SKU was definitely part of the basket. So they have higher resolution, but they don't have enough to infer headroom. So where else is that card spending money in another retailer and purchasing similar products? So that's where I think any one source is good, but joining those two sources to is really what unlocks the power. So from a fintech perspective, from a payment network or processor perspective, that is huge value that they're able to deliver to banks or issuers in terms of saying, here's the total amount of spend for this segment of customers in, let's say, a certain category like travel or in airlines. And that unlocks huge possibilities for upselling and cross-selling.
In your experience working with your clients, what are they for typical level of maturity in terms of data strategy that you're observing?
I think there are a lot of operational initiatives and tactics that are deployed in order to join data together and come to some form of insight. There is also broader strategy, but that typically gets slowed down or weighed down by mid-path corrections. So if I pivot to hospitality for a second, we were just in conversations with a large hospitality chain looking at about over 100. And for them, their data strategy was initially about moving from an on-prem installation of all their data and moving that to Snowflake. And midway through this process, I think there were challenges around, you know, will this unlock real value for us, or is it going to be a hugely complicated exercise where the migration of the data itself is going to become much more expensive than the ROI that we believe it'll release further down in the process? And we saw this data strategy getting pivoted midstream. And now the approach that they're taking is, let us defer the whole data cloud decision. Let us just lift and shift the current instance from an on-prem to the cloud version or the latest version of that same database provider while electing the latest data cloud 1 year down the line. Okay. Now, ostensibly, it sounds like a good compromise. You know, you have optionality with size later down the road. The challenge with this kind of pivot midway is a lot of replication is going to happen. You're going to shift the same data sources. You're going to shift the same data pipelines into a new environment, and then reconnect your, let's say, your data science models, your visualization dashboards. You're going to connect to this new deployment. Mm-hmm. And after that, you're not really going to optimize your costs around this new deployment because you're expecting to be a tenant and not an owner. And so you will then wait for the right data cloud to come along, while at the same time incurring operational expense and not necessarily realizing the benefits of moving into a newer environment or a cloud environment where you can run more complex analytics or you can share data more easily like you would in the case of a Snowflake. So that, in essence, it defers a lot of the value capture that you could have got. Now, having said that, there are unique constraints in this kind of a client situation. Of course, maybe their operating expenses and their budgets are being constrained by what we're seeing in the travel environment. But at the same time, I think it's symptomatic of organizations reacting to technological advances, but not quite sure about whether they'll capture ROI. So I think that shifts the onus on providers like a Snowflake or a Databricks to kind of make the value more obvious and convince the stakeholders within those data organizations that, you know, we are the answer. And that's where I think it's a very interesting development that we saw in the last 2 to 3 weeks where Sridhar Ramaswamy has assumed the leadership of Snowflake. There's a lot of emphasis on AI. And while we didn't see the market react very favorably just yet, I think the renewed emphasis on AI is definitely going to unlock value for companies that are already on Snowflake, because they are also doing their bit in terms of exploring generative AI applications and trying to prove ROI back to the internal organization.
That's great. Really interesting. Obviously, I'd love to hear more about the AI piece. Is that going to help me with my migration, or is it more on the generative side or, you know, it sounds like you're saying that you can't really compromise that lift and shift from on-premise to the cloud doesn't make sense. You really can't do it in stepping stones. There's no intermediary step, really, that makes sense. Is that fair?
Yes. So if you had a source and a destination very clearly outlined in your strategy, then you could definitely look at not lifting and shifting immediately, but actually making all the optimizations required to land in a way that your data sets are optimized for the cloud and for driving analytics workloads. But when you kind of introduce an interim step, you are essentially creating duplication. You're creating extra work, which is going to take more time. I apologize. I missed the initial question that you had, Martin.
Oh, just on the AI piece, you know, will that help with the migration to the cloud, or is it once you're in the cloud and the, extracting the value from the data once you're set up?
So we think that it'll definitely enable some of that migration activity because as AI gets smarter about what could be lifted and shifted versus what are the typical patterns in which data is accessed to enable analytics workloads. So for instance, building out semantic layers or, you know, the vector databases in which data needs to be organized to enable generative AI applications, there will be certain more AI enabled ways. We're already seeing automation.
Yeah.
So the lift and shift, a lot of that can be done quite automatically. Excuse me. We have enabled migration, which can, let's say, understand what are the tables and views and what are the data sets which can be migrated easily with minimal human interference. And then we have validation checks, which enable you to compare the source and the destination, run SQL queries or other queries off of both the data sets and compare the results. And if the reconciliation is good, then you know that your migration is successful. That is currently, let's say, rule-based, automated. Whatever is automated and rule-based is a fair game for AI to come in. And I'm sure that we'll see the evolution of that in the coming years.
I mean, a lot of the organizations that we speak to are really struggling with a data strategy, right, to really get started. You know, what are the first steps that organizations might want to be considering to really get started with their data strategy?
So we always suggest looking at the end business cases that they are looking to enable and drive data strategy off of that. So in a lot of cases, it's about being able to offer a stronger customer experience and enable very specific goals around acquiring more customers, looking to serve those customers in a more effective way, ensure lower churn, higher retention, and definitely look at driving on the engineering side, driving more efficient product development and speed to market. So if these are the goals, organizations should actually trace back from that and figure out what kinds of workflows make the most sense, what kinds of architecture are the right architecture for them. This would have implications in terms of, let's say, you know, what kind of data lakehouse you decide to migrate to, what kind of pipelines you build out. So for instance, your choice of hyperscaler would dictate to a certain extent what ETL tools you would use, and then kind of move into the space of what kind of MLOps environments you would set up for your models to run, and then what kind of visualization you would have. So if you chose, let's say, an Azure environment, you would have a lot of work here in Synapse, captured in Synapse, and then piped off of that, you'd have Azure Data Factory. You would also look at Power BI and Power Apps as your fabric overall to consume those insights. So it's important to kind of have an integrated and holistic perspective for all of this kind of working off of the final use cases that you want to enable as an organization. It's important to have a 2 to 3 year view of that end goal. And it's important to kind of stay the course for those 2 to 3 years as well. I think that's the primary part of it. Now, within that, you also have to allow for flexibility in your data strategy to adapt to new changes that are happening. So if we rewind to, let's say, 2021 or so, we were still talking about BERT and transformers. Generative was not a word that was used in the context of AI. Fast forward 6 months further, and you're suddenly going to change your entire underlying databases. You're going to create semantic layers. You're going to create vector embeddings. And that has implications for your data strategy. So any strategy must be flexible enough to account for step changes in evolution, like we are seeing with generative AI, because we don't know whether generative AI is going to release a whole lot of ROI. But we definitely know that if we're not in the game to experiment, we will not realize the fruits down the line.
I think that's a really interesting point. Isn't that part of the issue, though, isn't it? From a kind of an investment point of view, when do you press the button on this? You know, is it on the one hand, you know, you're saying you've got to be in there experimenting now. On the other hand, you know, the evolution of technology is ongoing, and maybe a waiting and seeing strategy is also a viable approach. To what extent would you advocate for waiting and seeing? I mean, if you're a cautious CFO, CEO, and you're saying, well, you know, we might be a year into this investment and then have to basically recalibrate everything for the latest technology trends, and we can't really budget for that right now up front, and that's a major risk for us. So do you think that's holding some companies back?
I would think so, because I think from our perspective, what we're seeing in even more traditional industries, like let's say the leaders among CPG, even those that are facing cost pressures. So let me back up a second. Mm-hmm. If we look at CPG as an industry, most of the top players have exercised pricing as a lever, and they have realized whatever revenue growth they could out of it. So now they're really looking at going back to basics, pushing volumes for various brands and categories, and at the same time, optimizing their cost structures. So it's a challenging environment to be doing anything new. However, we are also seeing some of the largest players, whether it's large snacks and beverages manufacturers, whether it's top five consumer brands, whether it is consumer health brands that are, you know, in the $15 to $20 billion range. Everyone is setting aside a significant budget for generative AI and hiring some of the top leaders in tech, and they are forging ahead in terms of experimentation. And there is a reason for that, because you can't be left behind in that race to learn, because when it comes time to deploy, companies are going to move ahead and the gap is going to widen. So it's important to have a car in the race or a horse in the race, depending on your poison, but you have to kind of be experimenting at some scale. Now, having said that, there are ways in which you can optimize that to focus your experiments on very specific use cases, which you can. Now, here's where the deferment strategy comes into play. You can choose to scale those applications which are more relevant to your business and for which the time is right. So if I were to take, let's say, one example, which is more publicly known, in November, we were invited to be part of a select group of partners it's called the Data Lab Partnership. Unilever is focusing very strongly on product innovation, and for good reason, because almost 85% of products that are launched today actually just fail. And that is expensive for CPG companies or FMCG companies. And Unilever has taken a look at this and said, you know what, we need to be in the code on underlying attributes of product innovation. What is the ingredient? What is the pack size? What are the benefits? And then what are the claims? Let's try and identify the combination of these attributes that are most likely to succeed in the market. And we are helping drive some of the key components of this strategy for Unilever. What that is enabling Unilever to do is improve that or reduce that failure rate as compared to market. So what that means for Unilever is when they hit the market, they're going to be releasing more products which are more likely to succeed more quickly. And that will widen the gap between them and their company. So I think it's important to get onto the bandwagon quickly, but have your horses in like a bunch of different races so that you can pick out the ones you can evaluate at a later point in time, which ones are doing well, and then really scale those ones.
It seems to me that, you know, it's even more crucial right now in this era of technology investment for, you know, the business side and the technology side and the data teams to be completely aligned and working cross-functionally and being led by the strategic business goals.
You're absolutely right, Martin. I think that collaboration between the business and the tech sides of the organization, or even in certain cases, it's analytics or insights, is extremely important. We've seen organizations doing this in a few ways. The first way is, you know, you have, let's say, a CIO organization, and you have a digital organization and a data organization. So there's like three variants. In certain cases, one or two of these report into the CIO. And then there are other cases where analytics or, let's say, even data is embedded into the functional organization, which then collaborates with the business. So you have marketing, which then owns its own analytics sub-organization, and then marketing collaborates with a business line. So whichever is the product line kind of collaborates with marketing. Both have their, all, each flavor has its advantages and disadvantages. I think the goal of all of these structures is to really enable speed to market and with a high rate of success.
Okay, perfect. So, I mean, you know, we're coming to the end of our fairly brief conversation. Well, let's just finish off by talking a bit about, you know, the 2024 and what do you think are the kind of priorities that organizations should be thinking about for this year and next in terms of data strategy?
So from our perspective, we definitely believe that organizations should be increasing their focus on the customer, which then means that they should be looking at aligning their data strategies to deliver the best customer experience, to be able to understand customer journeys in the best way, and align their both their product and their marketing organizations on that data strategy so that they can collaborate. So that's I think one of the primary areas where we see today's world breaking down into silos of data, of initiatives, and of outcomes. So I think that's possibly the most unifying thing. The second trend I would say is there's been a lot of focus on data being the gold, right, which everyone has to mine for. So whoever owns the data has the most value. We believe that whoever can derive insights from the data has the most value. Mm. So it's essential to be able to tap into the wealth of data. And this is especially true for fintech and payments, because again, the volume and velocity of transactions and the data there being generated there is really untapped when it comes to actually being able to reach out to merchants and help them provide personalized offers to their customers. We are still seeing pieces of that data. Obviously, there are ways to kind of navigate around or fulfill all requirements around privacy, around regulations, around other constraints in the model, but at the same time, deliver value to that end customer so that the offers that I am getting as a customer, I am more likely to take them up, because that kind of unlocks value for the customer, it unlocks value for the business and overall as well. So I think being able to be customer focused in a broader way has implications for how I tap into the data. And there is a lot of untapped wealth, which only, you know, which then requires you to have a service oriented focus to extracting insights from the data. That is where most organizations should be focusing in today.
Okay, great. So, I mean, you know, before we go, let's maybe just go into a couple of case studies just to bring it to life, if you may, particularly around that personalized offers piece, which, you know, we see in hospitality being an often talked about topic, an opportunity, right? So for unified commerce, so, you know, you might have, there's a tendency to have different payment providers for face-to-face transactions and card-not-present transactions. And if you can actually unify that those transactions and have a 360 view of your customer from a data point of view, then opens up, you know, opportunities for you, particularly around personalization of offers.
Indeed.
Do you have any good examples or case studies of projects like that, or other case studies of you know, some of the more transformational projects that you've worked in?
Certainly. I think payment networks are, some of our payment network clients are actually focusing quite heavily on this. The reason why is because payment networks have the ability to really look across the category of merchants in a certain geography, or even across geographies, and actually offer insights that the merchants themselves might not be able to access. And from that perspective, if you look at unifying identities across card not present, and therefore other kinds of transactions, it is possible and that's what we are enabling for our network clients, to be able to pick areas of merchants and go back to them. So let's say travel and airlines, right? We're able to today, what we're able to do is look at cross-border, which is a significant component of spend, and help some of our hospitality, some of our network clients hospitality clients or airline clients or others understand what kind of spending might be coming their way. So if we pick a couple of countries, right, let's say the US and UK. Today, if I as a customer purchase an airline ticket from the US to the UK, then a lot of the retail businesses in the UK would be interested in finding out about that. A lot of the hospitality chains would be interested in securing my stay spend. Therefore, it is always valuable for a hotel chain in the UK to understand what leading indicators are there of travel to the UK and understand who I should be targeting. Now, yeah, go ahead.
Oh, no. I mean, you know, I personally, we've got experience in working in the propensity modeling, right? So payment propensity by postcode aggregated up, you know, and identifying spend, velocity and propensity in different categories, et cetera. And some of the most interesting projects that I worked on is where you actually append data sets to really enrich that data. So you might get that card data and append it with other demographic data. I think going back to the point you made earlier on in the conversation is where you can kind of, you know, really enrich your own data set through partnership, collaboration, that kind of thing. Is that something that you'll see?
Absolutely. It's a huge trend coming up in the retail space for sure. And the reason for that is retailers capture the shopper, whereas payment networks and payments fintechs capture the transaction. Right. There's immense value, as we were discussing. View into the basket combined with cross-retailer view is very important. So if I'm targeting a customer, and I'm not a retailer or a fintech, I would like to see a data set that joins both of those and enables me to target them. So if I'm, let's say, a consumer company, I would like to be able to embed my demographics, my overall customer personas into what the retailer is telling me about shoppers and what the payment data is telling me about that segment of shoppers shopping across not just that retailer, but other retailers. So now I have a much better understanding of my target segment of customers. And that's, again, those are areas where we are helping some of our clients as well. When we were talking about the hospitality provider, I think one of the interesting use cases we solved for them was to provide incrementality around the number of customers acquired. So the product in question was a co-branded card for the hospitality chain and an issuer bank. Their current context was that they were having the targeting models based off of the payments data, and they were able to drive a certain amount of acquisition. So about 55% of the customers finally acquired were actually being captured by their targeting models. When we looked at this situation, we realized that there was merit to our earlier point in the conversation around joining data sets together. We pulled in hospitality data, we pulled in stays, we pulled in loyalty, we looked at all kinds of customer experience and survey data, and we piped that, we kind of cross-referenced that against the payments data available from the issuer. And using that, we constructed a graph-based network, which allowed us to look at intent and model the causal drivers of intent for each of the customers, and then score them on what would best move them towards the acquisition event. And that allowed us to drive up the percentage of customers captured in our targeting from the current 55% to almost about 78%. So this led to about 10,000 new customers being acquired for the co-branded card on a monthly basis. So over the course of a year, we ended up capturing about $1 million in new credit card fees alone, to say nothing of the other purchases and the transactions that emerged from that.
Excellent. So targeting basically you mean by that sort of more accurate targeting and therefore a higher level of conversion?
Absolutely.
Okay. Through better data analytics.
Through better data, as well as being able to look at it from a graph perspective and deploy machine learning off of those graphs. Because that uncovered the latent relationships across many of those customer sets, what they're purchasing versus coupled with where they're staying, how much time they're spending, and you know what the average duration of stays is, what kind of rates at which they're purchasing those stays. That allowed us to understand how to, you know, what the causal driver, that allowed the model to figure out the causal drivers mm-hmm. and then recommend based off of a propensity score who to target.
Okay, great, Shira. It's been great talking to you today. How can the audience reach out to you if they want to find out more?
We are at latentview.com. We are on the web. We are on LinkedIn. And I'm also definitely very excited to have some of these conversations. So I know my contact details will be possible.
We'll definitely put all the links in the show notes. But yeah, I mean, typically LinkedIn seems to be the sort of destination of choice as opposed to any other platform currently. So yeah, great. Thank you again. And we'll no doubt speak again soon.
Thank you, Martin. It was a pleasure having this conversation. Thank you for having us, and I'll wish you a great weekend ahead.
Thank you. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoyed today's episode. To hear more interviews, please do subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or your podcast platform of choice. It helps and means a lot. Also, I welcome any questions, ideas, or suggestions, so feel free to make contact and say hello. Reach out to me on LinkedIn or at edgardunn.com. You can send me a message there, or you can email me on martin.kodrish@edgardunn.com. I look forward to hearing from you, and I will see you next time.